Hey guys, welcome back to Unleashed, and man, it's good to be back with you guys. I didn't get to release this podcast on the normal day, which would have been yesterday on Monday. I got Montezuma's revenge, and if you have ever had that before, you know exactly what I'm talking about, and it is not a whole lot of fun. My office was actually a much smaller room than this yesterday, and I spent probably several hours in there, and I think you can read between the lines on that one. Anyhow, Eric is not here today. I'm doing this from home. The next two episodes are actually going to be from here. So just kind of get through some of the stuff to begin with, and we'll get into the meat of the podcast. I flew out last Thursday. I got invited to go on an amazing trip. It was an all-expenses-paid trip. You know, I'm not here to try to show off and, you know, tell you about all these great adventures that I had to fund. I didn't. I mean, this is one of those things where someone steps up, my friend Tim, great friend, and he just says, man, let's get you out of town, and took me down with a couple of his buddies. They have a company called Midwest Paving, and if you ever are looking for, you know, someone to be doing the paving like that, you can find them. They're out of Noblesville, Indiana. And if you go to the bottom of their website, I love this. They have a scripture verse. I think it's out of Proverbs at the very end. It's basically about committing what you do to the Lord. But his buddies were Doug and Matt, and they have a place down there in a boat in near Fort Lauderdale. I think it's like Lighthouse or Lighthouse Point or something area. But man, it was gorgeous. The temperatures were a little warm. It was a little humid, but we had some amazing adventures, and that's kind of where I'm going to take you today a little bit, and we'll kind of share some of that. We'll move it from Florida to Alaska. You know, I love Alaska, but I was gone from, like I said, Thursday to Sunday night, and of course, you know, if you're gone from your wife and she can't, you know, go to a beautiful place like that, she was working. When you come back, you know, there's a little bit of a sting to it. So on Monday, you know, I wasn't feeling real great, but I thought, you know what, I need to bless my wife. So I went and I got her a dozen roses, and instead of having them delivered, I, you know, hand-delivered them to her office where she works. And I was trying to get real creative. And I had written a song for her, well, I don't know, maybe 2 years ago called I'm So In Love With You, and I recorded it. And I had it in my phone. And so as I'm walking up to her office, I see this elderly couple, and the man's on a walker, and the woman's kind of holding his arm. They come out, and they just get out of sight of the office window, and I stopped them, and I said, hey, to the woman, I said, would you do me a wonderful favor? Would you be willing to take my phone in there? And there's this beautiful blonde woman that you probably just saw her. She's sitting, like, to the left on the desk. Her name is Stacy. Would you take my phone and go in there and say, hey, I found this out in the hall, and it's somebody's phone, and there's music playing on it, and maybe they'll come back for it. So I teach her where the play button is. So when she's supposed to walk in the door, she's supposed to hit play and take this phone up to my wife saying it's something she found. And my wife's going to be like, how could that song get on their phone? So I'm standing outside, you know, I've got these roses and the door is open and my wife can't see me, but there's another woman that can, and people are in the hallway, or, you know, waiting for this kind of a YouTube romantic moment. And the woman can't get the thing to play. And she's walking up to the desk and she goes, I found this phone out in the hall and maybe someone will come back for it. And she comes out in the hallway and she's so apologetic. She's like, I'm so sorry, I couldn't get it to work. And I'm like, it's fine. So I walk in and my wife sees me with the roses and she goes, what's this? Looks like your phone. And I'm like, it is my phone. This is what I had set up, and I kind of just blew it. But anyhow, I think it was the intent behind it. But it was a beautiful thing. So let me just kind of go back to where we were. So we get down to Florida, and I have to get up like at 2:30 in the morning, which I hate doing. Even on hunting season, when I got to get up like at 4 or 4:30, I didn't even know that time came twice in the same day. But when you're doing some of these adventures, you've got to get up early to get that early flight. I think our flight was like at 6:30, and we had to, you know, fly down to Fort Lauderdale. It was like a 2.5-hour drive flight. So we fly down. We, you know, get to the airport. We drive to Matt's house, which is down there, and he's got a beautiful home on this canal. You know, there's hundreds of miles of canals with all these homes and yachts and, you know, these Vikings and Sea Kings, all kinds of great boats. some of them are unbelievable. So we get on the boat, we get everything ready. We have to get all of our stuff and gear and bait and licenses and all that stuff taken care of once we get down there. It's kind of late in the day. We're not going to fish. So we get on his boat and we go out past the lighthouse, go out into the open ocean. We go south. I don't know how far it is, maybe 20 miles to Fort Lauderdale from the lighthouse area. And when we get down there, we're going through these canals to get to this restaurant. And he's like pointing to me. He's like, yeah, those houses over there, those belong to Cher. Remember Sonny and Cher? I mean, these things are, you know, $10, $15, $20 million homes. Cracks me up when they were pricing Trump's Mar-a-Lago at like $18 million. When you see some of these that are $10 million that would fit in his closet almost, and they're that much money. Yeah, something's up with that. But anyhow, went down, you know, tied off at this restaurant. We had scallops for dinner. It was incredible. And I was just blessed. I mean, this guy's like, nope, put your credit card away. And the only bad part about that night was those little things called no-see-ums, those little mosquitoes. You just bite the snot out of your legs. But wow. I mean, getting back on the boat, you know, it's now dark and we've got our lights on and we go back out into the ocean and we're going up the coastline and you see Fort Lauderdale all lit up. And I'm just out there, just taking it all in and just feeling so blessed. And I was kind of praying, I'm like, God, what can I use this week, you know, for the podcast? I was thinking about you guys almost the entire time when I'm out there, because this matters to me. I always believe that God puts some of these opportunities in my way so that I can bless others and maybe bring some great stories, which we're going to do today. It'll be kind of fun. So the next morning we get up. And we're going to head out early. I think we headed out like at 6 or 6:15 or something. We've got, you know, all the fishing gear. We've got everything that we need to bait and these big Shimano reels. They had pen reels. I mean, just some deep sea, massive, you know, reels. Not like the little stuff we use for, you know, pan fishing. Try to say that twice. Just we're fishing at about 150 to 250 feet, something like that. And we're trolling the whole time, maybe doing about 7 to 8 miles an hour as we're trolling. And we've got, let's see, there was Doug, Matt, myself, and Mike, the next door neighbor, and his son Nicholas. Nicholas is 13 and a half years old, and this kid is amazing. These guys, and we had our guide's name was Andy. He's kind of one of those, you know, crusty older guys, about my age, crusty older guys. But he's been out there. He knows his way around the ocean, how to bait, how to fish. And when he's the guide, you know, he's taking control of that boat. And so the day before, he had been mentoring Nicholas, this 13-year-old, because Nicholas wants to be able to be, you know, a fishing guide when he gets older. So he's, you know, teaching him how to do everything. You know, we got the outriggers, you know, he's teaching him how to hook the bait the right way so it'll stay on and you know, where to, just everything you can imagine. And sometimes he'd get a little bit, you know, firm with him, saying, boy, you got to get on that. You got to have a line in the water at all times. We can't be having empty baits. If you're going to be doing this with clients someday, you got to keep moving. And so it was kind of fun to watch. But the kid was a trooper, man. He was like, nothing was really distracting him. He was a little bit slow at first, but these men, because they were firm with him, but they weren't negative to him. And then when he would do some stuff good, they'd say, there you go. That's how you do it right there. You could see the respect and everything that he had for them and that they had for him, being a young man wanting to learn this stuff. Just an amazing time. So, you know, watching someone be trained and mentored in something like this, and we were on, it was a 39 foot, and I think it's an HCB, I forget what the boat is, but it's an amazing boat. You can be out there and you can have these rough waves going, and they've got something down in the hull that keeps the balance right, so that you're not being tossed around a lot like a lot of the other boats would be out there. So it makes it could be a really rough day, you know, it makes it kind of pleasant. And he's got two twin 600, so we got 1200 horsepower. I mean, this boat can really, really get it. I mean, we were doing upwards sometimes when we were cruising of 40 miles an hour. I mean, it can move. So let's see. The first one, I think it was Nicholas. We had all of our lines out, and boom, you see one of the outriggers, you know, pops a line, and the young kid, Nicholas, grabs it, and he brings in, I think it was a king, really nice king. And if you're watching the YouTube version of this, I'll try to put some pictures up, and maybe even a video. if you want to pop over to YouTube and watch these, of some of these fish that we caught. And so then it was my turn, and I've got a line off the back of the boat, pole bends, get the good hit on it, bring it in. It was about a 4-foot barracuda, and wow, I might even put that in the picture for the podcast. Just a beautiful, huge barracuda. Teeth are just like a hypodermic needle, like a syringe. I mean, they are so sharp. As a matter of fact, our guy just in the gill trying to get a hold of this after we gaffed it and brought it on, I mean, just the gill slice his hand, and he's bleeding all over the place. But man, it's just like, I've talked before about how in Africa, everything can stick you and kill you. Or in Alaska, you know, got all kinds of crazy stuff. You forget what's underneath the ocean sometimes. And there's stuff, you know, bigger than our boat that can be down there. So really, really cool stuff. So day one, we did dinner in Fort Lauderdale. I talked about that. Day two, we got all of our stuff together and we were fishing, and then we came back that night, filleted everything out right there on the dock and grilled it up. Just, ugh, it was incredible. So day three, we get ready. We don't go out quite as early. We go out like at 8 o'clock in the morning, but we're going to be going for spiny lobster. That was part of the fishing tag. It was like $5 you can add on to get this. And we were going to go to a spot that was only about 29 to 30 feet deep, where these lobster are. You know, you can pull them out of these rock, out of the reef and stuff. And the water was a little bit rougher that day. And so a couple of us were going to snorkel and go down and try to do this. But as bad as it was, we just said, you know what, you guys that have certifications for diving and have your tanks and everything here, they went down. So we stayed on top of the water, which was a really great thing, because one of the guys, they got down there and they found out one of his tanks was leaking oxygen. And that's why you don't dive alone. You have, you know, your buddies with you keeping an eye out for you to make sure in case anything happens that you got backup. So he comes back up. We get him on the boat, switch tanks. They go back down and one of the diving flags comes off of one of the guys swimming down below, and we see a piece of it drifting away. It's like anything can happen. What was really crazy, though, you know, they came back up. They pulled out, I think we kept three lobsters. They had caught more, but they had to look, and some of them were pregnant, and they had to put them back in the reef. But we had, the day before, when we had been out fishing, there was a dive flag we came up on, and there was no boat anywhere near these guys. And when you're, you know, you're moving to get to your fishing spot, and you're doing, you know, 35 to 40, and you come up on a dive flag out of the blue with no boat, you can almost run over it. So you really got to be paying attention. As I was getting this podcast ready yesterday morning, I was reading an article about, it was down in southern, I think it was in the Keys in southern Florida, where a diver got hit by a boat. He had severe head injury and an arm injury, and they had to get him out of there. This was like a month ago. I'm sure you could find it on YouTube if you look for it. But having that marker out there where others can see, you know, where you are is so important. And so we had to really pay attention, and we were tied up to a buoy in the area that we were diving, and we stayed right with these guys so people could see that this was a dive ship and that there was active stuff going on. We get back to the house, you know, and we got these lobsters, you know, and got them all, get the tails off and grilled them all up. And we're sitting behind the house and we're watching, he had a television up there, we're watching this thing. And there was a video of down towards Miami of where an inlet, you know, comes out, in the mouth of it comes out into the open ocean. And people stand there and video when the weather is bad, because people will try to be going out to the open ocean. And it's like the worst churning washing machine you have ever seen. I mean, these, you know, 10-foot waves smacking these boats, and they're coming up on end and standing up. People are being tossed out into the water. I mean, it's, there would be so many people that would be dumped out of these boats sometimes. It's almost like taking a handful of peanuts and just throwing them up in the air. That's what it looked like. But why would people ever go out in some crazy, you know, stuff like that? So we were sitting there kind of watching all that stuff. And it's just a reminder that anything, you know, when you're talking about ocean and the power of water like that, anything can happen in a heartbeat if you're not paying attention. And you got to make good choices. So I want to take this conversation. Now, I want to go from the warm waters of South Florida, you know, to the icy waters of Cook Inlet. I have shared with you before about Cook Inlet on here. I love fishing. We used to go up in a Zodiac, and we would fish 5 or 6 miles, you know, off the coast. out in Cook Inlet. Cook Inlet's like 30 miles wide, 100 miles long. And, you know, every 12 hours, you've got these massive tidal changes that are happening. And when the when you get some of these tidal bores that can be so low, you can, or when the tide gets low, you can get some tidal bores that'll come in there, you know, 8 to 10 feet high. Guys will actually be surfing these things. It's nuts. But we got stranded, and I forget which podcast episode it was, but my buddy and I got caught in a storm when we were coming back in, and off the coast right there, there's a little town called Nanilchik, and then Deep Creek pours into Cook Inlet right there. And we would launch our Zodiac out of Deep Creek and then go out into the mouth and out into Cook Inlet, where the commercial fishing boats, there's these things that look like log skidders. And they would back the boats, these big, you know, seaworthy boats down for the, with fishermen full and go out to the open ocean. But we would go out of Deep Creek. But every 12 hours, Deep Creek, you know, just changes the height of the water. And I think I might have shared once before, there was a guy that tried to take his pickup truck in low tide through there, got it stuck through across Deep Creek trying to prove how bad his truck was. And he had to get a ride back to town because he got it stuck. And when the guy gets back, he finds a buoy tied onto it, a local fisherman tied on, because the only thing you could see left was the buoy. That's how much water depth can change. Well, we got stuck out on that on the Delta. The Delta is maybe an eighth of a mile, something like that, off the coast. And we bottomed out on that, and it was in a storm, and we had to get our raft, our Zodiac, back out of that, get it turned around, and go way down shore, maybe another mile, before we could get back in and go to a safer spot to enter the Deep Creek. But as we're out there fishing that same day, my buddy Wade's telling me that he had an experience here years before where he and his wife had been out fishing. She was, I think, like 6 months pregnant. And they were warned, you know, be careful about going out in some of these cold waters, because if she were to, you know, fall in for whatever reason, you know, you could lose, you know, the baby. And these waters are cold. I mean, you've got about 10 minutes in that water before you lose all feeling and you can't hold onto a rope or anything. So he's telling me the story about how they have been out fishing, and you're across from these two volcanoes. I think, what is it, Mount Redoubt and Mount Iliamna, I think. And they saw the storm forming, coming their direction. So they, you know, motor it and get back in. And as they're heading back into shore, they see all these big commercial fishing boats that have been going out earlier. They're all there because they know what storms were coming in, and they all have come back. And they're off to the side, they're staging off to the side of this delta because they know they can't go in that way. But you would think they're staging ready to be picked up by these log skidders to get them out of the water. And that's what they figured they were. But nobody was going into shore. And as they get closer, now the tide is ripping and you got these big rollers are going on. He said, you know, you would be down in the trough of a wave and you couldn't see shore anymore. And then you get back up on top and you could see it and your gears flying around. I've been in that kind of thing in this exact spot. But it was really bad this particular day. And when they got up on the top of the one wave, what they saw explained why these boats were all off to the side. They couldn't go in because it was too shallow where the delta was. But there had been a 20-foot riverboat which had capsized with two fishermen inside of it. And as they're watching, first one of the boats, one of these commercial fishing boats with a V-hull, which is really dangerous to try to do this, he tries to go in and rescue these guys. And two different times, a massive wave hit this fishing boat and about capsized the whole thing, which, you know, that bad news. We just saw that yacht just sink off the coast of Italy here just maybe a week and a half ago. And I forget, but there was quite a few deaths on that. It's tricky when you're inside of a boat and things get flipped over on top of you, because not only can you be trapped, but you can have stuff hitting you, knocking you out. So after making several attempts, and it's been 10 minutes now that these guys have been in the water, we're on a timeline now. And so that boat has to get out of there. He can't do it. And Wade looks at his wife and he says, if we don't do something, these guys are going to die. Are you in? And she's like, let's do it. So they go in on the Zodiac. And, you know, Zodiacs are unsinkable, but when you get thrown into these icy waters, even though you might be able to cling onto the side of a Zodiac and hold on, someone being able to come to your rescue, like I just talked about in this space, it probably isn't going to happen. So it's pretty much a done deal. You're not going to make it out of there. But they go into this thing, and they could, the way they first noticed what was going on was they had like life jackets and coolers and everything flowing by them. That's what helped them understand why all those boats were staged over there watching. They knew something had flipped over. And they see this boat go popping up on end so far out of the water with these waves, you know, the props extended, everything. You can see this 20-foot riverboat, huge. And these things are like a brick. And it came smashing back down right beside these guys, and it's going to hit them. And so they see the first guy, and he's not holding on, and he's kind of broken loose. And so you've got in a safety rope that you have in a bag that you carry with you when you're out like this in the open ocean in case someone would go overboard. And the boat's being tossed everywhere, and they're trying to stay out of the way of this riverboat that's going to hit him if it comes up in the air again. Realizing this guy is not going to make it, Wade gets this safety rope, and it's got to pay out right. When you throw it, it's got to be put away just the right way so that when you throw this thing, it'll pay out perfectly. And he literally goes right across the guy's arms. And the guy, he's losing so much feeling, he can barely hold on. He's almost just using his arms, if I remember right from what Wade said. And they pull him over to the boat. Now, this is a 200-pound man. And the Zodiac, in these massive rollers that are going on, like a churning washing machine. And they try to get him into the boat. But now they're realizing with all the weight of everything he has on, he's probably closer to 300 pounds. And so it takes them several tries until both of them get a hold of his life jacket and his belt, and they just fall back into the boat, which is full of water and their gear. You know, everything is just kind of floating around. And this guy is so exhausted that he's laying like face down in the Zodiac, and they're trying to go back after the second guy, but they got to watch this guy because he's face down in water, and he can't even move. He's lost so much strength from this cold water. So they're keeping an eye on him, keeping an eye on this boat going up in the air that's going to come down and smash on him. They make a run to this last guy who is holding on, and he's done. He's toasted. He's just got his arms around it. He can't use his hands anymore. They throw, and now the rope is not in the bag anymore, which it usually is all tangled up at this point. It's not going to pay out like it should. And Wade said he said a prayer and said, God, I need this to work. He said, Brent, I threw that rope. He said it pay out exactly how it should pay out. And it comes right around this guy's arms. And all he can do is hold on with his arms. They get him to the side of the boat. And that big riverboat came up in the air, stood on end, and is falling right beside them, crashing out. And Wade can say, I can remember just saying, God, you got to move us. He said, and somehow one of those waves kind of split between them and the riverboat, and the riverboat crashes down just feet from them. They're able to get this guy, and they look up to shore, and they can see all these people now running down into the water because they can see that they're going to be bringing these guys in as fast as they can. So these other people put their own life on the line, going into this cold water, you know, up to chest deep or whatever they needed to be, and they get these guys safely into shore. They had emergency vehicles that had been called. They get them to the hospital, and these two men both lived. And Wade and I had written a book years ago. It was called Dangerous Men. This was actually the copy of it. I don't even know if you can still get this. I think this is the only copy I've ever had of it. But in the book, these men, months later, write Wade and his wife a little kind of a poem to thank them. And here's what it says. It says, clinging to the side of our capsized boat at the mercy of the raging sea. No hope to swim 50 yards to shore. Most lost were Dan and me. Our plight was seen by a man and his wife, and throwing caution away, they saved us from most certain death in the waters of that cold, cold bay. Dan and I will e'er remember the rescue that they dared, and God will remember, too, we know, the love for man they shared. And then he signs his name at the very end of it. I can't even imagine, you know, in circumstances like that, you know, where does courage come from, you know, in moments like that? I was thinking about young Nicholas that I was telling you about, this 13-year-old kid being mentored by these older men, teaching him how to be smart. You know, there's times that he might do something that was a dumb mistake. He's got to be really careful out in the open ocean. And they would be a little firm with him and saying, no, do not get on the back of the boat by the motors to try to pull that rope out. You know, you can fall in way too easy. The motor can get you all kinds of stuff. But with courage, when you mix that with wisdom, and when you mix that with understanding who you really are, your identity in Christ, you know, to live as Christ, but to die as gain, there is a courage that you can't just muster out of your own experiences. There's something that when you see another life in danger and you know that your life belongs to the one who made you, no matter what, there are things you can do sometimes that you never could have dreamed. You've heard of, you know, people pulling cars off someone when that flipped over on top of them, superhuman strength. But, you know, having courage in those moments is something that it just happens within us. God put that in us. And I've said on here before, when a man knows who he is in Christ, he's a dangerous man, dangerous for good. But there are circumstances that we face in life that are very similar to those type things. It might not be on Cook Inlet, it might not be in South Florida, right? But there are circumstances in our life where we literally feel like we're drowning in our sin. And we don't always have like a dive flag. We don't have a dive flag for people to see, hey, I'm really struggling here. Because men, we don't like to admit, you know, our weaknesses. We don't want to be able to have someone see us in a vulnerable moment and like they need help. Like, no, we want to somehow think we can do this on our own. But the truth is we can't. When I'm speaking at events sometimes, I'll be in like in a church or somewhere and I'll say, hey, I want to ask you guys all a question for a second here. And I'll say, I want you all to imagine that you have an addiction. And we all do. We just don't realize sometimes that they are addictions. But I want you to imagine you've got a really bad addiction. It could be like alcohol, drugs, sex, whatever that addiction would be. And I want you to tell me, and I ask for volunteers, I want you, someone here to say, what could someone say to you while you're in your addiction that would not be helpful to you? And they'll say things like, well, if someone were to just say, well, just stop it. Right, the old Bob Newhart, well, just stop it. No, that's not real helpful. Or they might say things like, do you know what you're doing to your body? Or do you know what you're doing to your family? Or, you know, God must be so disappointed in you. I mean, really? You think that's going to help somebody in that addiction being able to make their way out of it? And so then I'll say, okay, now, we've all heard that. We can see how that could be damaging. I want you to tell me what someone could say to you that would build trust and help you through and make it out of your addiction. And then you begin to hear people say things like, I'm here no matter what. I am not leaving you. Don't we all want that? Maybe they'll say things like, you know, I'm so sorry that you're struggling right now. How can I help? Or you might say something like this. I know you're struggling with this right now, but I know the real you. Let's untangle the lies that got you here. And maybe the simplest one of all is to be able to look at someone and say, I just want you to know something. I really love you. That's the kind of stuff that's going to be able to help us, you know, make it through these addictions. And I think sometimes we want to fix and control others, but we go back to Romans 14:4 again. If there's corrections to be made or manners to be learned, God can handle that without your help. You know, we're called to love God, to love others. But like I said, out in the open ocean, you know, you've got a dive flag and you've gotten a boat right there that can see when you're in trouble, like we had with the guy losing oxygen, and we could make sure he had the right tank and get everything he needed. But we don't have something like that out, and we hide it, like I was talking about. And we have to create an environment, just like Tim and I and Doug, which were up on the boat while Mike and Matt and Nicholas were under the water. We had to create an environment that was going to be safe. We have their backs no matter what. We're watching out for danger. Other boats might be coming in, storms coming in, whatever would happen. We had their backs. We made it a safe place for them. And one of my favorite quotes from the book called The Cure, it says, imagine a place so safe. Imagine a place so safe that you can share the worst about yourself and actually be loved more, not less, for the telling of it. That's the kind of environment that we need to have. And when we can create something like that, it's like that lifeline that I was talking about. When a place is so safe that you can share the worst about yourself and I'm still going to be there and vice versa, we have each other's backs, we've got each other's six, that's the lifeline that we have, that we can toss to one another. Even when it feels like we can't hold on anymore, we know the one who made us will never leave us or forsake us. And if you're looking for the example of what does God want us to be for people when we're struggling, if you've ever had a lifeline thrown to you when you were at your darkest moment, You know, it probably saved your life in many, many ways. And you're going to be the one that I'm probably going to go to because I know you've been there. You have had that lifeline extended to you, and you get it. You understand. And that's the kind of person that I want to be, and I hope that's the kind of person that you want to be as well. We'll see you next time.